We are the One Story Podcast. We believe in the power of a story. Everyone has a story, and that story is meaningful. Your story can make a difference. Your story can inspire others. Your story is important. At the same time, ultimately, everyone's story is a part of one story, the Big God story.
It's not what you said. You're not who you said you were.
Hey everyone, we are back. My name is Drew, and I'm with Isaac, and this is the One Story Podcast.
That was a little guttural right there. We are back.
I was getting into my WrestleMania character. Remember the Ultimate Warrior?
He was the best, man. I had a shirt. That was like my favorite, like my first piece of clothing that I absolutely, you know, when you have that one piece of clothing, like I wear this shirt a lot right now, but I had a Ultimate Warrior shirt, man. I'd put it on and that was it, dude. I was ready to go.
Wrestling buddies? Remember the wrestling buddies?
Oh, yeah. The buddies.
I had an Ultimate Warrior one and my brother had Hulk Hogan, I think. That's funny.
You body slam him. Yeah. Get him in the Boston Crab.
Good old WWF.
Dang. Good talk, Drew. Good talk.
Hey, guys. We're just chatting away here on a nice Saturday morning. And sun's out now. It was overcast. Reports here in Huntington Beach. How's the weather over there for you?
I'm in Rancho and it's overcast. It's going to be, I believe, in the 70s today. So low 70s. Nice. So it's going to be, I think it's going to be gloomy for them, from what I remember, which, you know, for me, I'm more of a, I need that sun, you know me, I need the light. I need all of it, right?
Vitamin D.
I need it all. I need to get out there. And we're just talking about me just being, overly. So I like it. So it's all good though. It's always always a nice day.
Right on. So yeah, we got another show for you guys today. I don't know if we have to preface it too much, but how about a little ask from you, the audience, if you guys want to leave a rating and review on our iTunes, that would be helpful. Give us some visibility in the podcast world that people can find us and hear these amazing stories. I don't really got much. We kind of think we're deciding we're going to drop this one alongside of Mr. Mike Davis. And so we kind of talked a little bit before on Mike Davis's episode about kind of what we are feeling with everything going on in our current situation, which it's something that we should all be talking about and having the hard discussions that need to be had. But today we have on Von Jarrett, who's a fellow Lamaridian. I don't know how you say that. But he's got a really just awesome story. I remember growing up watching, you know, their age play football, CIF.
Well, it was funny. He was talking about Laguna, like when they played Laguna in the jam. I was there, and I remember. I was just like, man, this stinks, you know. Got smoked.
And it's funny if you talk to anybody. Hey, you know,
did you see his thousand yard stare? He's like, man.
but if you talk to anybody like La Mirada pre-2000 or pre-2003, it's like, when you know they went to the championship, it's just like, hey, who'd you lose to?
Yeah,
unless it was 1992 when they won the championship. Yeah, it was like, hey, who'd you lose to? Like your brother.
Yeah.
Did they lose twice?
They lost two to Mezcal Canyon. And then the year before, they lost to Bloomington in the semifinals. And then the next year. And then the next year they. No. So 94. No, they might have been the championship. It might have been CIF. Or it could have been semifinal. La Mirada
lost to Bloomington in the championship.
So that was 94, and then 95, they went to CIF again. Lost. They beat Bloomington in semifinals, then went to play Temescal Canyon for the championship. Crazy. Lost, and that was like an undefeated season. You know, I believe.
Yeah, and that's the thing. La Mirada, we're the Buffalo Bills of high school football.
And then for us,
you get there and you lose.
Yeah, we beat New. We lost to Newport in the semis, and came back the next year, beat them in semis, and went out to CIF and then lost to Newport. Man,
those sons of. Forgot we were recording.
Dang it.
But anyways, we got Vaughn on. He gives a powerful testimony. It was really cool just connecting with him and hearing his story. And then we touched just a little bit on the current situation of what's going on and his experience. And it's just one of those things where whoever you are, where you're listening from, to keep the conversation going about what's currently happening and do your part where you can to spread the good news of the gospel of God, of Jesus, which is... as Paul says, there is no Jew or Greek, which is basically saying any nationality, any ethnicity, it's all a part of God's family and his kingdom. There is no distinction. So we're all a part of it. And
I think that's kind of cool with about our show. When we talk to people that we've talked to almost everybody, you know, we interview, we don't know them, right? We're meeting them for the first time a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And, there's always that instant connection. You know, through Christ, and it's, you know, it is your brother and sister in Christ. I mean, I don't know if that's cliche to say, but it's true.
No, it's true.
And you just feel that connection. And I think that's awesome. And I kind of felt that aside from our, you know, the La Mirada heritage and mm-hmm. La Mirada connection, but although that would brought us a little bit closer together.
Yeah, for sure.
So.
Yeah, so I don't have any more. Do you got anything?
Let's jump into it. It's a good show.
I say we get right into the show. This is the episode with Vaughn Jarrett. Well, Mr. Vaughn, how you doing?
Doing well. How about yourself, Drew?
Doing good. Doing good.
So
welcome.
We had a question. 99. So you played.
Is you that
played
when you graduated?
You played varsity football. What, 97 to 99?
Yep.
Okay. So what year did we go to the championship?
We went to the championship both years that I was on varsity, actually, the 98 season and the 99 season.
It was 98-99. Okay.
Yeah, we went to the CIF championship both years.
So one of those was Mayfair, no?
Yeah, second year, 99. That was my senior year. Mm. We matched up against Mayfair. We had beaten them in the regular season in like a nail biter down to the last minute, and we were talking a good amount of trash on the field.
Oh my gosh.
And that La Mirada swag. So we thought that we would never see them again as seniors. And we learned a lesson.
Heartbreaking.
Later.
Yep. Dang, that's the same, Mayfair, that's the same for us.
Mayfair
junior
had
year.
Our number, man. Jeez Louise. Yeah.
Because we beat Mayfair in the regular season, our junior year, 28-0. Mm. And then we met them in the championship and they beat us.
And I feel for you guys. I know exactly what that feels like. And they had some history on their side when it comes to that.
Yeah.
I'd blame Mealy. He just got out-coached, man.
Hey, man, you got to coach better. You've been there before.
I don't know if you can tell,
there's still a sore spot there.
That is funny.
So what was the year before? Who did you guys play the year before?
We played Laguna.
I remember that.
They beat us without any remorse. I think it was like 56 yeah. to 12.
They had that. They had a running back or a receiver that was. Every time he got the rock, man, he would just 60 yards and 40.
Yeah,
60 you know,
yard touchdown, 40 yard
crazy.
Touchdown.
It was crazy.
Yeah, they had our number from Jump Street, man. You're bringing up old memories. To an upset mind frame, but yeah, they came out before the game started and they jumped up and down on the LM emblem at the 50 yard line. And I looked back and they had us beat right there, man. We didn't defend it. We didn't rush out to midfield. We stayed back and we were silent. And I think there's some connection we can make with silence at this time. Won't get you what you need. Right. So,
dang, I could see it. I'm sorry, man. It's just, you know, that's where we had that common ground, you know, on the gridiron of Lamar at a Goodman Stadium. You know, right. Again, we were a little bit younger than you, you know, played football a few years after you did. But, you know, there's definitely that bond. La Mirada, people don't know, it's a small suburban town in between L.A. and Orange County. And it's a good, healthy history of athletics and football. So we were just Kimmy and Drew were talking about it. We wanted to see what years you played because you know everybody has.
It was tough times. You only lost a couple games, but they were big ones. But yeah, you're definitely right, man. There's nothing like Llama Rock football and growing up in that and playing. There's definitely a fraternity there. So I'm with you, fellas.
So let's jump back and get into your story. What was it like for you growing up in La Mirada? Did you grow up born and raised there or?
Yeah, I actually lived right on the borderline of Whittier and La Mirada from the time I was 4 years old. So up and through elementary school, went to Whittier schools, and from junior high through high school, went to school in La Mirada. So it was interesting, you know, as you guys know, being from La Mirada and the Whittier area, it's predominantly Hispanic and predominantly white neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So obviously that dynamic being one of the few African-Americans there. But to be honest with you, I loved growing up there. I had good friends, tons of sports from the time I was small playing NJB.
NJB?
football. We won a lot of championships. And so, yeah, it was good. It was I love that city. Love growing up there. And,
Did you play for Pop Warner? Did you play La Mirada or did you play for Whittier?
Yeah, I played for La Mirada. Same kind of thing. Actually, it was vice versa. I played in La Mirada till I was in junior high, and then I went over to the Whittier Redskins.
I was a Redskin.
had some fun over there in Whittier. We had a good squad and played some good football.
That's so funny. So I played Whittier Redskins, and I played La Mirada High School.
Okay.
Okay. Like it. I always thought that Whittier had some I always liked our uniform. We looked like the Redskins, man. We looked good.
Whittier, everybody was a Redskin and they were all about it. In La Mirada, we had, you know, our royal blue and yellow, but we were like the Raiders and the Rams.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the different names.
Redskins was like whatever you named yourself.
I was a Bulldog one year for La Mirada. Yeah.
Bulldog. That's funny. So what was home life like for you?
Home life was good in the early days, man. Mom and dad, I've got an older brother, 4 years older than me. I've got an older sister who's 8 years older than me. And I think obviously they had some different challenges than I did growing up in those areas at that time. But home was good. We didn't come from a majorly religious type background. You know, my mom would pray and every now and then take us to church, something like that. But we did not have any type of like home church or any consistent relationship with God. But had just a solid family. My dad was always my coach. And we owned our home and we had a pool in the backyard. We just had, you know, for me, I had the life as a kid. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Grew up on a cul-de-sac with a bunch of friends in the neighborhood. So home was good. Home was healthy. Home was safe. But it was not a spiritual home.
Did you, who was God to you then? I mean, so you kind of knew of God, right? You're going to church a little bit, but who was God to you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there was definitely a sense of God, and there was, for me personally, actually, now that you guys are reminding me, I actually probably had the strongest relationship with God as a child in my whole family. I look back now, we have pictures of, even when I was about 7 years old, I would go by myself, a church from Cerritos. I don't know how I connected with them, would pick me up in a bus, and I'd go by myself to church services on Sundays.
Really?
And then when I was about 12, there was a little church called, I must have been 9 or 10. There was a little church around the corner called Lighthouse. And it was walking distance from my house. And I would walk by myself and go to church at that church, 9 or 10 years old. So for me, I think I always had like, you know, a desire for God and awareness of God as a young kid. And even when I would do something wrong, I would have this like, you know, this emotional, like, kind of this gravity experience where like I knew God was there. I knew God was watching, either happy or unhappy. So at a young age, that's what it was. And then shortly thereafter, I'd say by the time I hit 11, 12, you know, God was an afterthought, man.
Is that just from, you know, other things become more important, friends, hanging out, that kind of thing, or?
Yeah, I think it was a combination. I think at that age of 11 and 12, as a young boy, right, you're going through some hormonal things. My family, actually, that was the age where things began to separate. My parents separated when I was 11, 12, lost a home, different houses. And then, yeah, the influence at that age, you know, you're talking 1992, something like that. Like, you're getting into music, your friends are hanging out, you're getting this free time and this exposure, especially because your parents are not really focused on the family at the time. So I think it was like a perfect storm of the world just kind of taking advantage and me willingly going that route, you know?
Divorce is hard, man, especially when you're that age, when you can... you're aware of everything that's going on. I mean, for the most part, right? You don't know the details of what your parents are going through, but just to see that separation and you're talking about living in different homes. I mean, that's heavy. That's heavy.
Yeah, it's a difficult time for any kid. And I think for me, like I said, my dad was my hero. He had always been the coach. He worked in the city of La Mirada. He was well known. So it's like everything that you are building your life on, or the things that, especially at that age, you think like there's certain things that you can just count on. And to have those things crumble before you is extremely difficult. And then shortly thereafter, my father struggled with drug addiction. So I remember having conversations at 12, where my dad actually sat me down, primetime pizza in La Mirada.
Primetime pizza.
And told me, son, I'm addicted to methamphetamine.
Wow.
And I need help. And so when you're... again, your world is crumbling. You're talking about things like this that you were not prepared to talk about. And then shortly thereafter, he was actually incarcerated for my whole high school life. So I was fatherless from just as soon as that starts, obviously, until you leave for college. I think the first time I saw him was from eighth grade, was right around my high school graduation. And then a few weeks later, I left for college. So literally had only seen my dad a few times in a matter of about 8 years.
And I would say that time, I mean, you always need your parents, you always need your dad. I mean, but I believe during that time is probably one of the most crucial times in a young man's life to need their father. Right there in that age group. I can't even imagine. And did you feel shame about that as well? Or was there any, what kind of feelings were attached to that?
Yeah, as I look back, there was some shame. There was a lot of anger, but I was, honestly, it's weird. I was more of a sensitive kind of guy and kind of kid. So I was more sad than anything. You know, the anger would come out when, you know, just the ways, things that I didn't have any help dealing with. You know, I go from being the all-star athlete to my dad's gone. And now I'm kind of being targeted, you know, growing up in La Mirada, like we talked about, you get to that age as well. And I'm not playing anymore and can't figure out why. I got kicked out of eighth grade and wasn't allowed to play sports at Benton in La Mirada. Couldn't figure out why. There was these things that were happening to me. You know, I started working at 15 and fired from a job and accused of stealing. And it was all those things that were like happening in my life where not having a father was crucial and difficult. And trying to overcome all those things, right? But again, my father and my mother had laid such a good foundation that, like I said, even growing up in La Mirada, where most kids aren't working, I worked from the time I turned 15 straight through high school until I left for college. I still had an over 3.6 GPA coming out of high school, got a scholarship to go to college. The foundation they laid was amazing, but the enemy, man, he's no joke, man. He had my heart, he had my mind, and that's what it was like in those years.
Mm. Where'd you work at?
So my first job, I worked at KFC off of Imperial and Edwards and Meyer. And I worked there for a couple of years. And then I worked at In-N-Out in La Mirada.
There you go. I think I was
16 to 18. And that was because they paid like $2 more than minimum wage at the time. And I was like, why would I work at KFC anymore?
That was the one off of Trojan Way, right? Yeah, that's how we went in La Mirada. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, that was what high school was like. I'd go from, like you guys said, being on the football field Friday night lights. You're a superstar. Saturday morning, flipping burgers. That was a high school life.
Making fresh fries.
That's right.
Where'd you go to college?
Burgers. What's that?
Where'd you go to college?
I went to Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. And then what was that like leaving home? Your dad is just getting out of jail. You haven't seen him. And then you're headed off to college to a whole different area. I mean, I never been up there to San Luis Obispo, but I know it's different. It's a different culture. Yeah. It's completely different than where
Longmont is. You get a chance, you need to go up there. Yeah, if you get a chance, you need to go for sure. But it's like, for me, number one, I was ready to go. You know what I mean? Like, that was my goal from the time that my dad went away. I said, I'm going to get myself a scholarship, and I'm going to get out of here, and I'm going to prove, you know, had a chip on my shoulder that I'm going to prove people wrong about me and about what I'm capable of. And I actually had a scholarship to UNLV, and that was where I was planning to go, which, thank God, I didn't end up in Las Vegas at 18 years old. But long story short, the coach from UNLV get fired. You guys might be too young for this, but John Robinson got fired from USC and ended up at UNLV. So he brought his USC coaching staff, fired everybody from UNLV. My coach that gave me a scholarship at UNLV ended up at Cal Poly. So he called me and said, hey, we've moved. We can offer you a scholarship here. And again, not having a dad around to help you through that process was difficult, but I was happy to be there. You know what I mean? But when I got there, it was surreal. San Luis Obispo is like, I don't know. It's like Pleasantville. It's a strange environment to be in, but I grew to love it. If you get a chance, you need to go up there. But it was similar to being in La Mirada. You know, the demographics are majority white. It's a polytechnic school. So, you know, it's high academic. Yeah, those years were interesting. You're kind of coming of age, becoming a man. You're out on your own. And I think those years were the first years that I realized what it was like to have peace. You know, I grew up in a house with a lot of violence, a lot of arguing, a lot of yelling. And then in high school, I actually had to live with other people for my junior and senior year because of what my parents were going through. So I stayed with friends for a couple of years. Mm. So to be in college, to be living on my own, to be self-sufficient, you know, I woke up one day and realized that I wasn't having nightmares. I don't know if you guys have ever experienced stuff like this, but when you grow up in an environment like that, you'll wake up with night terrors where you hear screaming, or you wake up thinking you got to go break up a fight between your parents. I think it was probably about 9 months into being away at college that I realized that I hadn't had any of those dreams for a long time. So college was good for me, built good friendships, grew up a little bit. But on the other side, it was also an amplification of some of the bad things I was involved in. I started getting high in high school. I was drinking in high school towards the end. And now you've got a license to do those things when you're away in college. So Spiritually, it was definitely not a healthy environment, but yeah.
But getting away from the, I guess the chaos from home. And like you said, not realizing you weren't having these nightmares and everything that went along with that I mean, I'm assuming it was a relief, but did you feel any kind of like guilt, like you're away from it and you're not there to maybe help you know what I mean? Like you're removed from it. And
yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And honestly, at that time, no, because again, I was only 18, 19. So if there's ever a time where you're the most selfish in your life, I would say that's probably the age. So honestly, soon as I got out, I wasn't thinking about mom. I wasn't thinking about my brother and sister. I wasn't thinking about my dad. And, you know, if I needed something, those were typically the times that I would call. Or even when I would come home, I'd come home to see my friends. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And spend maybe a few hours with my family. So, it was definitely a selfish season where I wasn't really considering anybody else. And I was fully embracing my freedom and the joy like I said, having made it out of a situation where I feel like the odds were stacked against me.
Absolutely. That's what I was just thinking. I'm like, you know, for you to be able.
And that's understandable. Yeah.
But for you able to make it out, that's what I was thinking. I was like, man, you know, most people would have buckled under that, you know, especially with just the household, you know, not being intact, and then, you know, having your dad and then having to work and do school and sports, like, man, that's a lot for
a lot of pressure
for a teenager. It's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot. I can't even I'm thinking about my kids. You know, my kids are homeschooled and I just, You know, it's like, well, they don't want to do math today. I'm like, yeah, it's a lot. Let's watch some more YouTube.
Take a break, kid. You're under too much pressure. Don't get it twisted, man. My kids are living that same kind of life, man. They're sheltered and they're protected and they're cared for. But that's what we want, man. You know, my story is definitely not what I want for my kids or expect or want for anybody else to have to go through. And even now, just reflecting on it with you guys, you know, I've always had this mentality though, where I'm kind of looking ahead. I'm looking to the next thing and I'm trying to move forward and I'm excited about life. So even when I was going through a lot of those things, it didn't really register for me how difficult it was. It was just, hey, this is my life and this is what it
pushing
means
forward. Yeah.
That's it, you know?
Go ahead, Drew.
I was going to say, you mentioned, you know, partying and stuff in high school, and we, you know, we grew up in the same town, same atmosphere. And that was kind of a part of, you know, the football and that culture, parties after the game. And Isaac, we got caught up in that as well. And then you said graduating and then maybe graduating on into college. Did it get more, and it sounds like it got a little bit more, maybe more intense, or it was more open, or you had the freedom to do what you wanted. What did that look like for you?
Yeah. So one of the things when I look back at La Mirada that just kind of blows my mind, what that culture is, that it wasn't just the kids sneaking around getting in trouble. It was like the parents were supporting that, like allowing us to party in their houses and buying alcohol for us. And I remember getting high for the first time when I was, I turned 16. It was like my birthday and got loaded. So that's why I said, I think San Luis Obispo and La Mirada are so unique, because getting to college, it was the same kind of atmosphere where, you know, 40,000 teenagers descend upon a city, and the city just embraces that. Like the bars let you in at a young age. You know, there's all these kids there without any type of parental guidance or accountability. So, yeah, you know, for me, I didn't really get into any other harder drugs, but I mean, I was high every day for 4 years while playing athletics. I wasn't much of a drinker. Like I said, leaving out of high school, I would rather smoke and get high, but there wasn't a weekend where we weren't in the bars at some point. And then San Luis Obispo, like I said, a college town, a party town. So there was major, I mean, 500,000 kids in multi-house parties. It was just, it's not even the real world. That's how I felt about it when I look back on it. It's like, it does not prepare you for the real world, and it makes you think that life could actually be like that. So that's what it was like for 4 straight years for me.
When did you start to realize that the smoking and the drinking was actually a problem?
Not till after graduating. Actually, I wouldn't even say graduating, after dropping out. You know, I had some pretty good years up there, and I had some NFL teams looking at me, and I actually had a couple of my teammates get drafted by NFL teams, and the scouting report came back on me that I was a pothead and I was angry. I wasn't the best teammate. You know, in La Mirada, we always won, so it was easy to be good teammates. I went from losing, you know, 2 games, I think, in high school to a 3-7 record my freshman year, a 3-7 record my junior year. And I was just angry. I didn't know how to lose, and I was mad at teammates. So long story short, that played into my addictions and my behavior. And so coming out of that, I think there was shame when I didn't get drafted. And I was angry when I didn't get drafted. And I'm watching my players that I play with that you guys know how it is. We know who the best players on the team are. And that's really where we were at. So I ended up getting signed to play for the San Jose SaberCats, and
that's a arena, right?
Yeah, arena league. So I got signed to play for them. So I dropped out of college after 4 years. I didn't finish my degree, and I went up to San Jose, and that was a shock. It wasn't like college. You're dealing with grown men who are doing a job. They're not playing a game, and so there's no love lost there. And I was still getting loaded and getting high and feeling isolated and feeling even more angry. And I ended up getting myself kicked off of the San Jose SaberCats for cussing out the coach and fighting the players. And so I get kicked off of the team, and I get signed to the Chicago Rush. and the San Jose SaberCats end up winning the Arena Bowl that year. And I watched some of the guys that I played with on that team get signed to the NFL. So shortly thereafter, I realized that I had a problem. You know what I mean? That obviously it's not all these other people that have a problem. It's actually me. I got injured the next season. I was home on the couch. I've never been injured in my life. And I'm loaded all the time, and I'm getting depressed. I'm getting anxiety, things I've never experienced before. It even started to consider suicide. And I remember asking my dad at that time, obviously he'd come back into my life, and he had gotten saved, but I didn't know what that meant. But I asked him, you know, hey, what do you think about me? And I was looking for some encouragement. I was looking for, like, you're going to be fine, son. You've got a good attitude, and you've always worked hard. You're going to make it. And he said, son, I wish you were a little bit sharper. And it kind of, it took me aback a little bit, because what he was saying is, you know, the drugs and your lifestyle is destroying your life. Like, I can't even talk to you because you can't even really hold a conversation. And at that point, I didn't really think there was anything wrong with me. I thought there was something wrong with the world, you know? And so I would say that was kind of the turning point of realizing that I might have a problem. Didn't really know what to do about it yet, but I was aware at that point.
So your dad found God.
Yeah. You know, when he was in jail, he was supposed to be in for a year and a half for a drug offense. And he ended up staying in for over 4 years, like I mentioned to you guys. And he would tell me during that time, like, it was like talking to a different person. Like, he just had, like, I would have been going crazy if that had happened to me. And when I would talk to him on the phone or get letters, there was this piece, something different about him. And so come to find out later that he had given his life to Jesus, and that's where his peace was coming from. He would actually tell us that was the best place for him, you know, to be isolated and to not have the temptation of drugs, to not have the temptation of, you know, the things that he was involved in and surrounded with. And then when he came out, we hear a lot of prison conversions. But, you know, he's still faithfully serving. He still loves the Lord, and his life has obviously been transformed and changed. So yeah, that was my first experience with what conversion is and what it means to really have a relationship with God, and seeing somebody that you knew so well for so many years literally just be a different person. But even still, I wasn't around enough to really comprehend it on a deep level.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you, like, did you think it, because you're outside looking in, you're like, you know, if you don't know who God is and you're seeing someone that's changed their life or they're talking about Jesus, and you're, it's like, good for you, I'm glad that medicine has helped you, you know, the God medicine. But it's a medicine, right? It may not seem real. So, but was it real to you? Did you understand it?
I didn't understand it. To me, it was more like a side story, right? Like, I was happy my dad was home. I was happy that we were able to talk again, and that he was happy and doing well. And you know, that was like a peripheral issue. Like, oh, okay, you have Jesus now. And he wasn't the type where he wasn't preaching to me. He wasn't telling me to read my Bible. He wasn't trying to get me to understand who Jesus was, which is interesting in hindsight, but he always talks about it. He said that God told him that if he would serve God, that his family would serve God. So he said that he just stood on that promise and he committed himself to serving. And now, one by one, he's watched almost all of his family come to Jesus. So
that's awesome.
That made it even a little bit more difficult to really understand or think about what he was going through, because he wasn't talking about it much. He was just living it out. You know?
So what was it that changed for you that eventually got you on that side?
During that time, I was about 22, 23 years old. And it was after I got myself kicked off of that team and left the Chicago team and was injured. I went into like a spiral, a deep depression, that I'd never experienced before. I was always a happy guy, and I was always, you know, life of the party, athletic, all those things, intelligent. And here I am, when I moved back, my mom was living in South Central. So not only am I home with my mom at that age after being gone all those years and experienced what I had, but now I'm living in South Central when I grew up in La Mirada. And it was just, there were so many things. And I found myself one day getting high. And so we would roll blunt. So I had a knife in my hand and a cigar in my hand, and I'm rolling this blunt. And next thing you know, I've got the knife on my wrist, and I'm starting to scrape a little bit. And I thought to myself, like, this is it. Like I'm done. And I was ready to kill myself. And at that time, my mom came home, my sister came home, and they rushed me to the hospital to try to have me admitted. And I wouldn't let them admit me. And I called a young lady named Mary. She was my first girlfriend when we were 10 years old, and we always stayed in touch, and asked her if she would spend some time with me. And she told me she would, but I would have to go to church with her. And so I'm thinking about suicide, and the only person willing to spend time with me says I have to go to church. So it seemed like a good deal to me. So I told her I would go if she would spend time with me and hang out with me. So we did that for about 6 months, and I was still getting high every day and wasn't listening to any messages. And then just one random, obviously I know it's not random now, but one random Sunday service. Well, the Friday I gave my life to the Lord. I'll tell you guys about that a little later, I guess. But something happened. I just encountered Christ, and that suicide episode and that depression episode where I said I used to think like only weak people would commit suicide. Only, you know what I mean? All the things like before when my parents got divorced, you build your life on certain things. And when that comes crumbling down, it's hard to deal with. And I was in that situation again. All the things that I thought would never happen to me were now happening to me. The things I thought I'd never do, like commit suicide, I had the knife in hand, you know? So it was a wake up call, but even still not enough to look for God. I was just looking for a friend, you know? But that was the beginning of the end of my old life. You know, something was on its way.
Yeah, no, that's good.
So you said you had your God encounter. You know, you're in church. You're in church, obviously pursuing a young woman. You know, like, you want to go to church? I like Jesus.
Let's do it.
So I totally get that story, right? That's my story. But you're there, right? You're there. You're some of it sinking in. What was it that hit you? What was that encounter?
Yeah, it's my favorite story, obviously. And it actually didn't happen in church. I had been going to church with her for 6 months. And like I said, not listening, not paying attention, getting loaded, and honestly just trying to get into her pants. That's the only reason I was going. But on a Friday night, October 22nd, 2004, I was with my brother and another couple friends, and we went to a preseason Lakers game at Staples Center. And on the way there, like always, we're getting high, we're getting drunk, we get into the game. And I had one of those attacks, one of those panic attacks, one of those anxiety attacks in the middle of the game, second quarter. And I start looking around, I'm nervous. I feel like people are talking about me. I'm angry. And for anybody who's been through experience like this, like you'll know what I'm talking about. You feel like, man, I don't trust my brother who's sitting next to me or our friends. I feel like I'm being set up. Being an athlete, my life was built around sports. So I felt like there was this conspiracy against me. I'm like, man, there's baseball going on right now. I'm at a basketball game. There's hockey right now. I feel like it was just the world was closing in on me. Hmm. And I got up in the middle of the second quarter and I ran out of Staples Center. And I went into the parking lot and I said, God, I'm done. If you're real, you got to be real for me. And if you'll do that, I promise you that I'll serve you for the rest of my life. And I got on the phone at that moment and I called all five of my family members, my mom, my dad, my brother who was in the game, and my sister, right? And I called Mary and I left them this message saying, I'm starting my life over. Everything's done. I apologize for anything I've done to you. And I ask that you would forgive me for anything that I've done to you. And I forgive you for anything that you've done to me. And the only one to call me back was Mary.
The rest of your family, like, I don't know what this
is. They're like, I don't know what's wrong.
Your brother was probably
tripping. Yeah. Yeah. He's like, man, he must have smoked something. He wasn't ready for this, you know? And so Mary calls me back and she's trying to figure out what's going on with me. And I wouldn't even tell her. I'm just like, that's it. I'm like, I literally in my mind, even when I answered the phone, I acted like nothing was wrong. So I'm like, I'm starting all over. It's new as of this moment. I have no hope. This is the only hope for me. And so I don't even remember going back in the game. I think I actually asked her to come pick me up and she picked me up. And So that was on Friday, the 22nd of October, 2004. On Sunday, the 22nd, we went to church like we had been, and nothing happened. Nothing happened on Friday. Nothing happened on Sunday morning. It was just like the skies didn't open, no lightning, didn't hear God. And we left church. I had a job, so I had to go do something for work. And she was constantly telling me about this other pastor. And I got angry. I was like, I need to see who this guy is because you won't stop talking about him. And I went like angry, saying, I want to see who he is, kind of size him up. I was still kind of yoked up from playing football. So I really was angry. And so we go walking into this church in La Habra that was connected to our church, and they had an afternoon service. And that was it, man. I don't know what he preached, but all I remember is being at the altar, crying and feeling God for the first time. You know what I mean? Like, I physically felt the burden of sin lifted off of me. I felt the hopelessness come out of me. And I've never, not before and not since, ever experienced anything like that. It was this moment where God was all of a sudden real. You know, I recognized that he heard me in the parking lot of Staples Center on Friday night. And he was telling me on Sunday morning that he had heard me and that I was saved. Man, the rest is history.
Dang.
That's awesome.
Dang. What church was this?
Jason Townsell had a church. It's a Praise Chapel church in La Mirada.
Praise Chapel.
And I don't know if you remember, obviously we're older than you, but Jason Townsell was a good friend of mine all through high school. He was 1 year older than me, graduated in 98, and he had gotten saved a few years before and planted a church into La Mirada, obviously to go back to the city he grew up in. And so that's the church we were going to. And even when we were going for those 6 months, there was maybe 8-9 people in the church. So I did feel comfortable going because I knew that it was, hey, this church is obviously about God, because there ain't no church. Now we're meeting in a continental breakfast room somewhere. This dude seems like he really believes what he's saying. That was a Praise Chapel church in La Mirada. And then the other church where I had my experience was obviously a Praise Chapel church in La Habra that had planted him into La Mirada. So small churches, homegrown churches. And that's what happened.
Dang.
That's awesome. And, you know, we've heard stories upon stories of conversions and similar to that, you know, like in that, for you in that parking lot and just crying out to God, if you're real, then you got to do something. And he does, he answers that. Cause I think at that point you were at the end of your rope when you were done, you're ready to give up all that stuff behind and follow him. And he answered you, you know, in a big way. That's just awesome.
He sure did, man. And and even as I look back, I was repenting for the first time. You know what I mean? I was like you said, I was at the end of ready to give things up, but also ready to acknowledge that it was my own fault. Like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, look, I'm here because of me. Everything I'm trying, even trying to get this girl to spend time with me, like, it's like I'm always grasping for something, and there's nothing else for me to grasp onto. There's nothing else for me to, I can't. Like everything else in my life that I've been able to fix and overcome, there's no overcoming or fixing what I'm going through now and what I'm realizing about myself. And if you guys don't mind, I want to share that the next 6 months were the hardest I've ever experienced in my life. I would love to tell you guys that after that, you know, it was kind of smooth sailing and God just came with a lot of comfort. But my experience was on a daily basis, God would bring me before him, and he'd show me who I really was. It was like it was the depths of my sin. It was the depths of my depravity. It was things that I saw one way, and then he would show me the reality of what I was doing and what I was saying and how I was treating people and how I was a liar and how I was a thief and all these things that you do not want to deal with, to the point where I had a lot of those same episodes like I had in Staples Center where I wanted to run. You know what I mean? I wanted to quit. I wanted to leave church. I wanted to just get away and go back to how life was before. You know, I know what it's like for people that want God and come to God and early on walk away, because I've never experienced that kind of difficulty to see yourself as you really are. It was more than I was ready for. That's why we need a church, and that's why we need people to help us. And I think a lot of times when people get saved now, we clap and we're excited for them and we can't wait to see their baptism day. But we basically see them Sunday to Sunday, and we don't realize that some of those people are going through something horrendous and horrific. So I always remember that. I've I struggled mightily during that time. Yeah.
And that's, but that's, I guess it looks differently for everybody, but when God comes into our lives, we're supposed to be transformed to become more like Jesus. And a lot of times that can be a painful process.
Yeah.
Because we're so far removed from what that looks like and the things maybe that we've done or things that have been done to us, working through that. Probably a lot of people don't stick with it.
Yeah.
They do just fall back or,
cause it's easier, right?
Yeah.
Cause it's easier to live a life.
The hard work is transforming, is facing, looking at yourself in the mirror and really seeing who you are, or, you know, God revealing that stuff. And that's heavy.
You don't have a point of reference for how to do that. When you first get saved, you don't know how to reach out to others. You don't know how to ask for help. You don't know how to have the scriptures as part of what's healing you and helping you. So again, as a pastor, you know, we've had our church going for 12 years now. We've had to learn a lot about how to do that well. Because, again, like I said, not only are you the individual getting saved, struggling with all those things, but a lot of us haven't been taught how to really care for people who are going through some of those things. And like you said, everybody's story is different. Some people have served God their whole life, or they've grown up in a Christian family, and their conversion is obviously just as significant, but the challenges that come along with it are different. So I think the longer we do this and the longer we walk with the Lord, you begin to see about just this idea of community and this idea of why you can't do it alone and why you can't forsake the assembly, why confession and compassion, all those types of things are so important.
What I want to know is what happened with this Mary?
Yeah. So thank God she stuck it out, because I don't know how she survived me during those times and those years, but we got engaged in 2005. So like I said, end of 2004 is when I had my experience with the Lord. 2005, we got engaged. And then on May 21st, 2006, we got married. On January 8th, 2008, we had our first son. And then on April, I think, 20th of 2008, with our three-month-old, we planted our church.
Wow. So, wow.
Her life. I don't know. She didn't know what she signed up for when she tried to invite me to church.
So in 4 years, God led you to actually, I mean, you got married and you had a kid. And now you're planning a church, which probably is like the craziest, you know, venture ever. Right. I can only imagine what that's like.
Yeah. I don't advise it. but for us, like, yeah, we could have used a little bit more wisdom in some of these things, but God's grace is amazing. But yeah, for us, like I said, when I got saved, I think I went through that season like I told you guys about, but I pursued God like I had done sports and like I had done school and like I had done everything else. Like I pursued my wife, I just go all in, you know what I mean? I only have two speeds, 0 or 100. And my intention was obviously not to pastor a church. I was so happy to know God. I was so happy for my little 8-person church that I told my pastor, I said, this is it. You tell me what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. You're going to disciple me. And I flipped the overhead. We had overhead slides. So I flipped the overhead slides. I was all about it, you know? And these people that I had already been in church with for, like, at that point now 9 months, I'm like, hey, what's your name? There's only 8 of us and I don't even know your name because I didn't care before I got saved.
Right.
But yeah, within that 3 years, I guess the end of 2004, yep, 4 years, we started our home Bible study in 2007. So 3 years later, I asked my pastor, I said, I want to start a Bible study, but I only want it for unsaved people. Like, I don't want a Bible study in the church. I want to reach my friends and family that don't know Jesus. And he gave me the green light to do that. And within a few months of doing that, we had 20 friends in our house, in our newlywed house. We only been married less than a year. And they would come every Friday night. We would cook dinner and I would ask them on Friday, you know, what do you guys want to know about? What do you want to learn about? They would tell me, and then I'd spend a week studying about it. And then I'd teach Bible studies here. And when we got to that size, my pastor said, we're going to have to plant you and start a church. And I said, no, like, that's not really in the cards for me. And they just wouldn't let it go. And eventually we got on board and we felt like we heard God saying the same thing. And in our naivete, we answered that call at that time. And it's been the best experience of our life. You know, we went from 20 down to 3 because people wanted God in my living room. They didn't want God in a church. So I think in hindsight, we could have done that better. But obviously, we've weathered that storm and people have come to the Lord. And it's been the best experience of our life, while also the most difficult, trying to figure out how to be married, trying to figure out how to become actual men and women of God, trying to figure out how to be parents, and then also trying to figure out how to shepherd others in that process. But just like before, I've seen God's amazing grace in ways like they're just miraculous.
So you've been married for 14 years. You've had a church for 12 years.
Yeah.
And now, you know, we're in 2020, you know, the beginning of a new decade. What is God talking to you? Like, where is he guiding you? What, especially in the midst of all this, right? This has probably been, you know, with COVID and now, you know, with everything that's going on with, you know, socially, like, you know, where are you at as a pastor? Where are you at as a father, as a husband, in this new decade?
Good question. And you're right. There's so much going on right now that I think there's a little bit of a difficult question to answer. I'll start with, when we started the church, we had a very simple goal. We said, if we can be used to change one person's life the way that our lives have been changed, then it's worth the rest of our life. Right. So that was our mentality when we came out, and we tried to hold on to that, because when you look at churches or you look at numbers and you look at ups and downs, it can be difficult to reconcile the investment of time and your life that you're investing. But we've been able to stay the course and remember that, you know, what it took for Pastor Jason to go out in such difficult circumstances, but what that did for us, I think it's worth his life, and likewise for us. So what I feel like God is saying to the church is that lives are still worth it. You know, salvation is still the most important thing on the planet. It's all that matters. Everything else is kind of the backdrop for coming to a saving knowledge of who Jesus is. So we try to maintain that focus and remember that that's what God's saying to us. I think what God's saying to the church right now is about depth of relationship, depth in your community, that COVID has reminded us that church is not going somewhere on Sunday mornings. You know, the church has had to be agile and change. I'll give you a simple example. Our children's church director sends a weekly email now to every parent. There's a recording from our prayer ministry on there praying for the parents and the kids. The kids have packets at home that they're going through. And it's like, COVID has reminded us that it's not just, can we keep the kids busy for an hour on a Sunday while their parents listen to a message? It's, can we minister to kids and plant seeds in a way that will change their lives forever? So I think that's a microcosm of what God's doing in the whole church, reminding people that this is a life. This is brothers and sisters that need to connect. Having conversations like this, you guys do these podcasts all the time, but for people like me, I've had more in-depth conversations via Zoom than I was able to have before COVID, because it's always hi and bye, high five, love you, brother, God bless you, and we're on to the next business.
Yeah, that's so good. Yeah, yeah. That's a good point. That's a good point.
So yeah, I think that's
a quick question. Will you continue the thing that you guys are doing for the kids ministry?
Definitely.
Past COVID?
Of course, man.
That's awesome.
We've prayed about as a team. There's things that are obviously going to go away as we're able to gather again, but there's things that have to stay that I believe are part of the reason why God allowed this season. So doing that for the kids is one of them.
Yeah, no, that's good.
Another one is we're doing our leadership meetings via Zoom. And a lot of churches wrestle with that tension. If you have bivocational pastors like myself and bivocational leaders that have regular full-time jobs, how do you get all these people together? And there's always this tension. Well, how important is God to you? How important is the church to you? You can't even make it to a meeting. I think one of the things a lot of churches have realized right now is that, you know, it doesn't mean God's not important to them. It's like we all have these challenges in our life, and we've had better attendance and better meetings via Zoom for our 15 or 20 leaders than we were having before. So it's things like that that I think God is challenging us to definitely not leave behind just because we're able to gather again, you know?
No, that's really good.
Man, that's wisdom right there, brother.
Wisdom. And hopefully a lot of churches are doing that and seeing, you know, post COVID or when this all kind of goes away, how don't just not going back to the same way that things are done, and finding new ways to be better at helping disciple people, than just the Sunday gathering. I think that's huge. And then, so we want to be respectful of your time. We're kind of getting up there on time, but, we did want to talk a little bit about what's going on currently. I saw you on social media. I think you were out with the family, protesting and giving your voice. And you said something earlier on the show here about being silent and sometimes, the proper time of when to speak out. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on what's going on right now with everything in the country?
Yeah, it's a difficult time. Obviously being Black, being an African American, I think I have a unique experience. Like we talked about earlier, also growing up where I grew up, ministering where I minister, just some unique experience, I would say. I think primarily my focus has been on the church. I think this is a national issue. It's a global issue now. But my heart is people want change for different reasons, and they're all valid reasons. But as a Christian man, I think when I talk about this, I'm speaking to believers that should have a foundation that is rooted in Christ. And if we can't get this right as the church, if we can't see it clearly as the church, and if we aren't willing to move away from any other alliances we have as the church, then I don't think there's much hope for the rest of the world. So yeah. I plan to continue to protest. I plan to continue to take my family to protest. I plan to try to be an advocate and a voice for people to understand that we need to widen our gaze. If you look at any particular issue of police brutality or any particular issue of racism, of course you can have lots of feelings about that. But if you widen your gaze and you begin to say that this is a systemic issue that begins 400 years ago with a people group being enslaved, then I think it's not about you saying I'm not a racist or I don't agree with what happened to that one person. It's about more of a problem that needs the same things that we need as individual Christians: repentance, reconciliation, restoration. And I think we need more voices that are willing to go out and talk about that. And the church can't be silent, and not just the Black church or the Black pastor. Any Christian should be able to look at that and be moved with compassion by the Spirit of God. One other thing I'll say, I know you guys probably have some other questions, but is that I do think this time in particular, things have been dramatically different. I've never seen so many non-Black people be so willing to make their stance heard, be willing to gather, be willing to protest, be willing to recognize a problem that used to just be a Black problem, and it's now become a nation's problem. I've never seen anything like this, and I don't think my parents, grandparents, or great-grandparents had ever seen anything like this. So I think there's more hope now than ever before.
Yeah, oh, that's good. And kind of what you were talking about with the some people say, you know, this isn't my problem, or I'm not racist, I don't have these feelings. But there's, like you said, going back hundreds of years, I think the Bible even talks about the Old Testament about iniquities. And I've heard the teaching on this, like, mm-hmm. it's not so much direct sin of a person, but it's the iniquities of the forefathers and what we're now seeing. And there's certain people that have that benefit from that, and there's some people that are hurt by that. Mm-hmm. And you have to recognize those things, those iniquities that say, you know, for someone that's white or that has privilege because of that, to recognize it and not so much a direct sin on their part, but to see the system and the things that have been put in place from slavery to, you know, laws, Jim Crow laws and all of that. It's a system over years of time of the sins of the forefathers.
And not only that, I'm sorry. I'm just going to add to that. Just as Christ followers, for us, leaving that legacy for our kids, setting that path, you know, so our iniquities are not passed on to our children and our children's children to, you know, follow God and glorify God in the best way and to be the best representation, be the best example to what you were saying, Vaughn, you know, as we try to change the way people are thinking and feeling, you know, about each other, to do it in a way that glorifies God. Yeah. But that was a good point, Drew.
Yeah, man. I'm glad that I'm talking to brothers in Christ, and I'm glad that you brought that up. It's actually in the book of Nehemiah, chapter 9. If you look at verse 1 and 2, it talks about that they've come back to the Lord and they're hearing the word, and it says that they came to repent of their sins and the iniquities of their forefathers. And the idea is that they recognized how far they had gotten from God, and they also recognized the only way to come back was going to be through that repentance of their own, but also through recognition of the sins of their forefathers. That is a principle that we see that's biblical, which is what I was talking about before, where regardless of your ethnicity, if you're a Christian, that is your principle. And if it applies to you as a people group, we have to acknowledge that as we move forward, right? So if you get a chance, go back and read through Nehemiah, especially 7, 8, 9. It's so amazing how they are in captivity, and the scriptures say that they haven't, since the days of Joshua, they haven't been reading, they haven't been praying. So Ezra gets up and begins to read the scriptures to them every day. And it says they start to cry because they haven't heard the word. And they tell them, don't be sad. This is good that you're hearing the word. And they start acting like it says, they're reading one day and it says, hey, we're supposed to have this Feast of Tabernacles, supposed to live in tents. And they say, well, then let's do it. And they start doing, so they're hearing the word and doing the word. And right after that is when you get to Nehemiah 9, where it says they wanted to repent of their sins and the sins of their forefathers. So the church, it's very simple. The formula hasn't changed. Listen to the word of God, apply it to your life and do it. And nobody will have to tell you to repent or to have sorrow or to want to see change. That's what the Spirit of God will produce in believers. So I'm glad you brought that up, and I hope people will be willing to go read through some of those scriptures.
No, that's really good. And just the fact of like realizing the sin in our own hearts, repenting of that, and how we've played a part into whatever societal issues there are, and repenting of that, and then trying to make a change and offer the olive branch or sitting at the table and understanding someone that's not like you or doesn't have the same background of you and just having the conversation. We did a podcast last night with Mike Davis, who's all about emotional intelligence and communication. And that's the thing, like people aren't listening. They're hearing maybe someone, but they're not actually listening and hearing the heart of that person. And I think that's what's so key, is to really understand what the other side is saying. Don't be so quick to dismiss it because it doesn't line up with your preconceived notions or beliefs. You know what I mean?
And not only that, try to put yourselves in their shoes, try to see through their lens and really try to understand what it is that they're feeling and going through.
So, like I said, it's a hard thing to do. And the last thing you want is people having to carry guilt. That's what repentance is about. It's not about being guilty. It's about actually being able to be forgiven so that you don't have to carry guilt anymore. I think, again, the best example of putting yourself in someone else's shoes is not, can a white person do that for a black person or a black person do that for a Hispanic person? I think it's Christ, right? When we read about him and we realize he didn't experience personally what everybody else experienced, right? But somehow, being Christ and being God, it's as if he has experienced everything we've experienced. So I think that's the mistake we make sometimes. We think, well, I'm never going to be a black person, so I can't experience that. Or I'm never going to be a white person, or I'm never going to live in that place. And if we have that mentality, it'll be very hard for us to get into other people's shoes. What I've seen as a pastor, especially, is that I have not experienced everything that the people that I shepherd have experienced, but God has called me to shepherd them. So I think he has grace for me to be able to be compassionate and to understand and actually feel some of the things that they feel. And I think if we go into our relationship with that perspective, we'll be much further along.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good. Well, Vaughn, we will not hold you up. You have any more? Go ahead, Drew. You had another question?
No. I was just saying, I kind of along the same lines of you, and this is a bigger, a huge conversation, yeah, right? And we're just touching on it. Wanted to kind of hear your perspective. And I think, but you gave some great insight of kind of how we have to approach this and how you approach it and how you're looking at it from a Christian worldview. I think is great to hear. But Isaac, you wanna?
Oh no, no, just and just thank you, Vaughn, for being with us today and spending some time and telling us. You know, you said something that's our mission for me and Drew and for all Christians is to help people understand the realness of God and that the Holy Spirit is alive. And obviously you experienced that, in your God encounter, right? I call it the Holy Smokes moment, right? But, so no, I just,
yeah.
Just thank you so much, man. I love your story. I love that, you know, you're living out God's, purpose in life that he had for you. And I want to connect, man. I want to go out to your church once everything goes back to normal and see what's going on over there, man.
Yeah. Do you want to plug where people can find you and the church, and when things start opening up, maybe people can check it out?
Yeah, definitely. But first, I want to thank you guys, man. This was a great conversation. I appreciate you reaching out and trying to connect and getting on the phone a couple times the last couple of weeks. This was helpful and healthy for me in a time where things are so crazy. Having conversations and thinking through things is so good. So thanks, Isaac. Thanks, Drew. Mm. Our church is called The Way, and we're in the city of Brea. Like I said, we've been there for 12 years. The website is thewayccc.com. You can find our app in the app store. It feels like a commercial. You can find our app in the app store. Just look up The Way Brea. And then on YouTube, obviously, we've been live streaming now, so you can find our services there. Look up The Way Media, so should be able to find us somehow.
I'll be tuning in Sunday, man.
All right. Looking forward to being with you. Thanks, guys.
Excellent. Thank you. With that, we just ask that you open your eyes, listen closely, soften your heart, and ask God to reveal himself to you.